The SparkFile podcast may contain profanity and other adult content.
Please use your discretion.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my SparkFile. SparkFile. To be something that I want to make or how I want to be, I pump it in my SparkFile. SparkFile. I jump into my SparkFile.
Welcome to the Spark File, your one-stop dollar store for creative inspiration.
I'm Laura Camion.
And I'm Susan Blackwell. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome. You may be asking yourself, what exactly is a Spark File? Where do I get one? What do I file in it? These are such good questions, and we have got answers.
A Spark File is a place where you consistently collect all of your inspirations and fascinations.
Here's the deal. We are makers who make all kinds of things.
If you're like us, and you're making stuff all the time, or you want to be making stuff all the time, you know the wellspring of inspiration can run a little dry.
So we're on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity, things that inspire us to get up off our asses and make things like this podcast.
Or a project lovingly handcrafted, start to finish by the same set of hands.
Or a body of research that helps the world understand itself better.
Ooh, every episode, we're going to reach into our Spark Files and exchange some sparks. And from time to time, we're going to talk to some folks who spark us too.
And if you're not careful, you might understand yourself a little bit better. So without further ado, let's open up
the Spark File. Weirdo.
Contrapuntal.
You're a weirdo.
Camion.
And I like you.
Hi.
Hi.
You're a weirdo and we like you.
And we like you.
Cams.
Yeah, baby.
I have something that is so exciting that I am eager to share.
Have to share
with
this.
The yieldy
share
listeners.
Share it.
So after our episode, and I know some time has passed because in the world of podcasting, the future, the past, the present, it's all
now.
Liquid.
It's liquid history.
It's all liquid history. Hashtag mudlarking. So after we aired our episode that included the spark that I did about hand-lettered signs.
That's correct.
I sent an email to the team at Southwest Signs in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
and this is what I wrote. Hi, my name's Susan Blackwell. I'm the co-host of the Spark File, podcast obsessed with creatives and creativity. You guys all know this, all this stuff. Blah, blah, blah. On this week's episode, we're talking about Chicago hand-lettered grocery store signs, Southwest Signs, and Chuck Wilmarth. And you can listen here. And I included a link to the podcast. I told them, and this is true, it was a joy to learn all about you and what you do. As you can hear in the episode, we admire your work so much. We hope you enjoy the episode. In related news, I have an idea for a sign that I've been wanting to have made. Based on a saying we discovered on another episode of the podcast, they were like, ladies,
you
this
and
is
your
all
podcast.
Too much. Podcast, podcast, podcast.
And here's a link to that episode.
I was hoping to have Chuck Wilmarth hand-paint it in chartreuse or yellow on a canvas that I purchased at a thrift store.
Yes,
I've
yes,
attached a
yes.
PDF of the as-is canvas. I included the measurements and an idea of what it might look like with the quote applied. The words are, we are all just walking each other home.
Mm.
In addition to the cost of shipping both ways, can you let me know how much it might cost to have Chuck letter the piece?
Mm.
All cap style in the Chicago knockout sign style.
Yes.
Would Southwest Signs be willing to do something like that?
Would they, Susan?
It's a cliffhanger. Thank you so much for the inspiration that your work provides. We love it so much.
Oh.
And imagine my delight.
Surprise and delight.
When I received an email back from Southwest Signs, I was
so awesome.
So excited.
I was too. We were not in the same location.
But we were...
Flipping the F out.
We were. So this is the email that we got back. Wow. We are so touched that you did this. We never felt that anyone noticed, but we always believed in the importance of this art, and we so love to make hand-lettered signs. Yes, we would be happy to help you. Not sure about the cost of shipping, blah, 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 logistics. By the way, we so enjoyed the accurate content of your podcast. And I just have to shout out to we're really...
To our fact checkers.
Our team of fact checkers working around the clock.
Good job, guys.
No, to the journalists who did the original stories that we draw from, like WBEZ.
Right.
And I mean,
that's correct.
Come on, without them.
All kidding aside,
we really are nothing.
We really rely on them.
I was like, thank you for the compliment, but that really does, I have to pass that along to those journalists. She went on to say, you might find it interesting that most hand-lettered sign businesses are family businesses, and wives and daughters are a big part of most of these businesses. Wendy, that's Chuck's wife, mm-hmm. and I, that's Dan's wife, dictate all the orders and follow through with making sure that customers get what they want and on time. The funny thing is, the more we watch them, the harder it looks to do. She means painting the signs. I so wanted to try my hand at it, and I was terrible at it, LOL. Chuck and Dan really appreciated your kind expressions. It made us proud, .. Chicago proud.
Oh.
Thanks to podcasts and public radio, we think you are helping put hand-lettered signs back on the map. And then they included some pictures. That was from Carol Comba, Dan Comba, Chuck Wilmarth, Wendy Wilmarth, and Jason Adelman. Younger sign painter, LOL. Southwest Signs Incorporated, Chicago, Illinois.
And we're going to post those signs, right?
Beautiful, beautiful signs.
Yeah, we'll post them on Instagram.
But can I tell you how excited I was about this thing.
Yeah.
This vision that I've had. And I said it all the way back on The Art of Dying
way
Well.
Back.
That
way
I wanted back. To have a... wanted to have a canvas made. We are all just walking each other home.
Yes.
I had the canvas picked out.
Yes.
That I got at the thrift store. And I was going to try, and I did some research about lettering it myself, but I was like,
oh,
you know what would be even better?
Yes.
An original Chuck Wilmarth. So anyway.
I always just did my Aunt Fran. No, you're not doing that. No, you're not having it. You have to have them do. No, that's too amazing.
It's like sparks on sparks on sparks.
Oh my God.
Sparks on sparks. It brings
and creativity on top of creativity on top of creativity.
And every time I see it, it will bring all of this, all of these feelings that I have back up to the surface. So I wrote back, oh my gosh, this is so cool. We're so excited to hear back from you. You really are like celebrities to us, and we love the work you make. Carol, we love that you tried your hand at this. I have a feeling if I tried, it would also come out pretty shaky. It reminds me of when I was a teenager. I thought because I had watched people cutting hair for years that I could cut hair.
Sure.
That didn't work out so well either. If you want to get a taste of that, please listen to That Makes Me Hot on the original cast recording of Now Hear This.
Oh,
now available wherever you get your records. Hats off to Scott Stoney, whose hair I cut. In any event, I went on to say, with your permission, we'd like to share your email and the photos with our listeners. We'd love listeners to know about the families running the business and how the women keep it all going. Please let us know if that'll be okay.
Whoop, whoop.
I just shared a little bit about us. Blah, 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 blah.
Blobs.
They wrote back and said, I loved having every time one of their emails came in, I was like,
so tingly.
I was so excited. But they wrote back and said, we're an open book. Go ahead and share. They sent a few more pictures. We talked about getting this sign made, and I am over the moon. I feel like by the time this episode has been posted, that I will have it back up. It'll be on the wall, and I will have taken photos of it and shared it out with all of you on social media.
Yeah.
So just a little update from Southwest Signs, Sparks on Sparks.
I love it so, so, so much.
It made me pretty goddamn
happy.
It's
pretty awesome. Yeah, yeah.
One of the it brought back to me another spark, which was I believe we were talking about in the Anne Lamott Bird by Bird spark, which is this is why I love all these creative endeavors, whether it's having a podcast or I want this sign made. I have this idea for this thing I want to collaborate on with, you know, these artists I admire. All of us, all of this just gives us an opportunity to have these adventures and to engage with people that we admire.
Yep.
And that's true of anybody listening to this podcast. It's all just an opportunity to have a better life during our time
on this earth. Planet. It's so freaking true. Yeah. And I'll just reiterate again, we love when we can outreach to someone and when they reach back.
Oh.
Like that same episode, Badass Cross Stitch.
Yes.
And Par Puzzles.
Yes.
And so anytime, like we just get so tickled, honestly, that first of all, people are listening. And second of all, that like they know they're seen. Their work is seen and respected and admired and appreciated. And that just pleases us.
It is a delight.
Totally delightful.
Truly. But let's get to sparking.
I can't
cams.
Wait for that painting.
I can't either.
I'm going to hone in on that because I want one. Because that saying, I mean, I'm just going to burst into tears. But that saying, that episode, if you haven't listened to The Art of Dying Well.
And you like a good cry.
Oh, it was a goodie.
Go on and give it a listen or don't. You
that
do
was
you.
A goodie.
Cams, you got a spark
what?
For
What? Am
me?
I going first? Okay.
I think you're first today.
I am first today, first in line.
My favorite. This is Christmas morning. Here we go.
Suze, you know I spent some time in Florida recently, which I love. And while I was there, I got to see my dad.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know how much I've talked about my dad on the podcast so far, but my dad is struggling with his health a little bit lately. He's had kind of a rough go of it for the last few years.
I think you've spoken of your father. I don't know that you've talked about that specifically.
With those details. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, just having health issues gives you pause and reason to reflect a bit, you know. So we're doing that.
Yeah.
We're in a little bit of a reflection. My dad lived his whole life as a teacher and a coach, I think I've mentioned, and as a craftsman. He would never call himself a craftsman. He's humble to a fault, but his craft is woodworking.
Oh.
And he taught high school shop class.
Oh.
He had his own furniture business for a while. He built custom furniture and particularly custom like kitchen cabinets. Cabinetry.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And so he always would have a project like that going on outside of school.
Oh, would he?
He would.
Get
he
it? It's totally. A pun that includes the word wood. W-O-O-D instead of W-O-U-L-D.
Mm-hmm.
What a waste of time this is.
Would. And my dad even built his house from scratch.
There.
From
not to objectify your father, but there is nothing sexier than a person who can build their own house.
I wasn't going to bring this up, but all of my friends thought my dad was super sexy growing up.
Is that true?
Creepy and weird. Oh my God,
no,
yes.
Come on. Your dad is human, and I've seen the pictures. Your dad is
totally
handsome.
At that time, they were like, oh, Tom Selleck.
He's giving you Tom Selleck.
Giving us Tom Selleck.
Yeah.
So everybody was all giggly about my dad, and I was like, he's my dad.
Tom Selleck
but
building a house.
He was super handsome and charismatic and funny and great attitude. And there he is building his own home. Literally every 2x4, every nail, his hands were on everything. The only thing he didn't do was pour the cement for the foundation.
Really? Could he do the tile and all of the plumbing?
He and one friend worked all summer and they built every inch of it. And it was truly awe-inspiring.
OMG.
Yeah.
That is something
to
be proud of.
It was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful home. And he just never stopped on it either. Like he would always be refining and adding things. Like here's some, you know, custom bookshelves over here. A built-in like desk with a roll-top desk that he made, you know. Yeah, I never got to live in that house because I had already moved to college at that point.
Wow.
But I have a million incredible memories from all of the holiday gatherings and family gatherings that we held there.
This is amazing. I just, tiny side spark. I've always had a dream of building a house. Nathan did not share that dream because he was like, I think that means I'm going to have to build the house.
We're going to build it, honey.
So as I've mentioned before, we've been renovating for a few years now. This very strange house it is.
Fabulous.
I mean, when we first
delightfully
got it.
Delightfully weird.
The interior
and we love it.
Looked like a fully themed Mexican restaurant.
I love it.
But we have been, when I say we, I really do mean Nathan. I'm decor, but everywhere we've gotten to this place now where everywhere your eye lands, he has touched, refinished, resurfaced, rebuilt,
it's beautiful.
Demoed and rebuilt. And there are certain things that, again, he has to job out, you know, but I got to tell you, this works me to my bones. I love it.
I was just thinking about, yeah. So obviously you do stand by your words of like, there's nothing sexier a man building a home.
And I always wanted to like be with a person like that and look
and
at.
You and you are.
And I love it.
And you love it. I do. He's amazing.
And the
He's
things we can accomplish together.
Oh my gosh.
I was saying to him the other day, like together
Endless.
With your brawn and my beauty, the things we can accomplish.
My dad and my stepmom were and are like that as well, in that she would do a lot of the planning and strategizing, basically, like first, you know, next thing on the list is the roll top desk, and then we'll do these cabinets, and then we'll do, you know, and she was always, I mean, without a doubt, instrumental in it getting done.
That's neat.
Yeah.
This is like the most niche spark in the world, but I could seriously do a whole spark on tambered, you know, a roll top desk that's tambered.
Yes.
Where you can get wood to sort of like roll and snake. I am obsessed with tambered woodwork.
Well, let's ask my dad about it.
Tambered doors.
Okay.
Tambered doors. Okay.
So my dad had a shop in pretty much every basement of every house that we lived in.
Sure.
The smell of varnish, smell of lacquer, all of it. I loved, I couldn't get enough of it.
So here for this.
Part of that might be the fact that it was actually getting me high. But besides that.
A thing.
Truly loved the smell of it. And if we didn't have room for the shop or the equipment that he needed, like we'd just go up to the school to work at the shop where he taught. So hours and hours of my childhood were spent entertaining myself while he got his work done in the shop. So the sounds and the smells of a wood shop are like deeply embedded into my childhood memories.
Oh, Kimian.
I know, I feel lucky for that.
Wonderful.
I feel lucky.
I love this spark.
So one of my biggest regrets, maybe my only regret, is that I didn't take his shop class. And I wish I would have.
Yeah.
He never pressured me to. I think he probably would have been nervous if I had. He used to joke that like all the kids in his class were hoodlums. And
I'm worried for your...
Yes, he would be like, you're not going to be down there with those guys. But he always said it with such a smile, and I'm positive a bit of pride on his face. Like he loved his students. Like he loved those shop guys. But... And I always felt like they were having a great time, but I think he didn't want me to date any of them. And I have heard numerous stories from people after the fact that my dad point blank told them to stay the hell away from me, like steer clear of me. They were not to date me, which really makes me laugh. Yeah.
He warned them off you. Wow.
Absolutely. He was like, mm-mm.
Wow.
So I think he was like, yeah, I think he was protective of me in that way. But the thing is, like, I was never talked to by anyone about taking a shop class or metalworking because I was being tracked for college and what you call white collar work or knowledge work, knowledge work. And I was guided toward the clubs and activities that would put me into leadership positions, from student council and speech and debate and theater and any training program, like say no to drugs. Like I was on part of that team that traveled to all the other schools and taught younger kids how to say no to drugs.
Did
you
do it through drama? Or did you
role playing?
Yeah.
Role playing.
Yeah.
You know, thank you, Nancy Reagan. There was a whole program that came with it.
I wanted to be on those teams.
Oh.
But
really?
I wasn't. Yes, I did. Because I was like, it's a chance to get up in front of people.
It's theater.
I'm made of ham bones.
Yes, it really was.
From lip gloss and ham bones. Yes.
So I was like tracked for all of that. Yeah. And I have no regrets about any of that. But. You know, I don't blame my parents. I don't blame the school counselors or anything. It's just the way that it was. And I know that they were doing what they thought was in my best interest. And probably it was. But I couldn't be sadder about missing out on learning a skill. And in particular, I missed out on learning my dad's skill.
From your dad. Yeah.
My brother did it, though. And now I can learn from my brother. But may pull myself together.
I actually love that you're, even though your father may not be in a position like physically to be able to convey that to you, all is not lost.
That is right.
Yes.
So I was drawn to a book a couple years ago called Shop Class to Soul Craft. Obviously, the title got me right there. I was like, excuse me? What? What is that? It's by Matthew B. Crawford, and it is an inquiry into the value of work. So the author, Matthew Crawford, got his PhD in philosophy. Talk about a thinking educational track. And he promptly went to work at a place called Information Access Company. His job was to read academic papers and condense them down into short summaries.
Ugh.
His quota.
I mean, hooray.
Ugh. Thinkers thinking about thinking.
Ugh.
His quota was 28 summaries per day.
What?
Yeah, I did the math on that. That's like 3.5 summaries per hour. If an 8-hour day. 3.5 summaries per hour, you could take only a little more than 15 minutes to read an academic paper and then write a synopsis for it. Yeah, it's crazy. Crazy.
That seems impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, to really read it. Clearly
to
you can't.
Really, right?
You just read the first page. You
well,
read
that's
abstract.
Exactly. He felt like so detached.
Yeah.
Like it could, like in theory, I suppose it could be something where you felt like you were learning, but he was like, no. This job left him exhausted, detached. Later, he became the director of a Washington think tank.
Mm-hmm.
And he says about his desk job, I was always tired and honestly could not see the rationale for my being paid at all. What tangible goods or useful services was I providing to anyone?
Hmm.
This sense of uselessness was dispiriting.
Hmm.
So I found this book so interesting because I think about my dad. To me, I know I was just a child, but I never saw my dad unhappy about his work. He loved coaching. He took a lot of laughter and joy out of teaching, and he loved making things with wood. He was meticulous. I mean, people would flip out about the quality of work he did. He took such care with everything that he made, and I would hear people rave about it and just feel so proud, you know? And I knew that my dad was really proud of me, but like I said, I can't remember a time when anyone encouraged me to learn to make things with my hands.
Yeah.
I was in 4-H, I will say that,
That's right.
I did learn to sew there. I'm thankful for that, but by no means did anyone expect that I might actually use my skills to make things or make money from making things.
Mm-hmm.
Again, no one's fault. It was the time period, I think, that we were living in. They had good intentions, but you know, if you showed a certain level of intelligence, you were tracked towards college.
Yep.
And this book, Shop Class to Soul Craft, really breaks down how problematic that thinking is and completely inaccurate in terms of levels of intelligence and what's required when making things. I'll get a little bit into that. But the book really resonated for me because like it talked about vocational jobs like mechanics, plumbers, construction workers, and how they have not traditionally been valued as highly in our culture as a position in management or a lawyer or an IT specialist, like jobs that handle information rather than having hands on.
Right.
So Crawford posits that there's a new economy emerging, and this economy doesn't distinguish between educated people and non-educated people. The divide will be between jobs that require someone physically present versus jobs that can be farmed out.
Oh, boy.
Bad news for the managers, that can be farmed out. You can answer a phone and send an email from anywhere in the world, but you can't fix a clogged pipe from India. You have to be here. You can't fix the roof from China. You have to be here. You can't change the oil on your car from Germany. And so therefore, only people who are doing the work that requires face-to-face interaction will be able to count on a stable career, he says, in the future. Skilled manual workers might be the most sought-after jobs after all.
Wow.
Interesting.
Interesting.
But we're currently living in a time when we fix things less and less by ourselves.
Yeah.
And yet there's an interest in manual labor that's increasing, but we're discouraged from fixing anything on our own. Like, we're just taught that it's easier to dispose of it and buy a new one. Or things are made complicated intentionally so that you can't fix it.
Yeah, because there's so many in things. There are like computer panels, like
that's right.
Even automobiles for as an example.
That is correct. Yeah. That is now basically a computer. Like, everyone's like, yeah. Oh, neat. You can just press a button and turn your car on.
Right.
But if you press that button and nothing happens, what do you do?
Right.
Whereas it used to be, you're like, well, get out of the car, pop the hood,
yeah.
And get in there.
Exactly.
But Apple products were like on the forefront of this. Like, one, how do you even open it? You can't, you don't know how.
Right.
Special tools could be required. So from an article in The Guardian, Crawford sees the dwindling of manual skills as part of something bigger and more alarming, a fundamental change in how we relate to our physical stuff. As consumers, most of us no longer make things, but buy them instead. We no longer fix things, but replace them. Appliances used to be manufactured in the expectation that customers might want to tinker with them, like detailed parts diagrams were often included. But these days, designers try to hide the works. Gadgets feature strange screws that can't be unscrewed using normal screwdrivers.
Uh-huh.
Some cars are designed so that all you can see once you lift the hood is a smooth, impenetrable surface, effectively another hood.
Mm-hmm.
We become passive and dependent and more easily manipulated. Our physical surroundings no longer hold our attention, and we start to succumb to what Crawford calls virtualism, a vision of the future in which we somehow take leave of material reality and glide about it in a pure information economy. This is the vision peddled by numerous commentators on the future of the internet, an ethereal, anchorless world in which all we do is exchange ideas, where everything is funded by advertisements for everything else, and in which all that matters is the production of knowledge, not the sewers and the electricity networks and the kitchen tables and the washing machines on which the knowledge producers will still presumably rely.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you track that?
100%. It really is like we have been sold this sort of vision of the future that is virtual, that yep. It's sort of like it is this like very smooth.
It almost, it's sold to us as this is better for you.
Yeah.
You're going to like this more. Don't
like
worry about any of this stuff.
Yes,
right?
Like seamless
we'll
and
take care of
smooth
it.
And utopic and...
But he's really talking about the intentionality of this shift. And it's a fact. Historically, the separation between thinking, air quotes, thinking, and from, air quotes, doing was intentional. And this got really, really interesting for me. I was taught in school that the assembly line was genius and good for everyone. We created more jobs,
right.
More cars. They could tout efficiency, efficiency,
yes.
Efficiency. It was good for the overall economy if you were a business owner. However, it was literally designed to devalue the work of skilled labor.
Mm.
Let me tell you how. If you think about it, if you're the only person or one of a few people who knows how to build a bike, start to finish, your knowledge is valued and you can pretty much charge what you like or what the market will bear for, like, how badly do people want a bike?
Mm-hmm.
Susan, you're the only one I know who can make the whole thing and I will pay you for that knowledge. However, if you only know how to put part of the bike together.
If you only now know how to put the spokes.
That is correct.
On the wheel.
You're not quite as in control
valuable.
There.
Valuable, yeah.
So in the early 1900s, 1909 to be specific, a man named Frederick Winslow Taylor published a book called Principles of Scientific Management. And it was highly influential in these years. And I think Stalin and Marxists, like there's a whole bunch here that I don't know about, but I'll just tell you about this book. His ideas revolutionized employment in the U.S. and the way businesses ran. His idea, and there's no like apology for it. Make no bones about it. Here's how management should run.
Yeah.
this is what's going to put us in charge.
Mm-hmm.
He advocated that you break up complex tasks essentially so that business owners and management have all the power and that they would no longer need skilled workers. For example, if you divide the work into small, simple tasks and give each person one assignment,
yes,
then unskilled, quote unquote, low wage people could be employed to do the mindless things,
yes,
like screw in a bolt. And they each had a small task, but none of them knew the whole picture.
Oh my gosh. I'm sparks on sparks
right
now.
So yes. No one knew how to build a bike. They only knew how to do their one task. And if you employed a large number of them, you could cut the skilled worker entirely because that person demanded a higher wage for their knowledge.
Yes.
By using the system, the only people who saw the whole picture were the managers.
Wow. This is bringing me back to when I interviewed my father for mm-hmm. the piece that would eventually become the Golden Palace.
Uh-huh.
My father talked to me about how out of like financial necessity, he went and got a job, a highly sought after job,
yeah,
at a factory,
yeah,
working essentially on an assembly line, and how it mm-hmm. was like so boring and so like soul crushing because all he had to do was take, he described like his part of the job, his part of the assembly line was popping this, what was essentially sounded like a washer into
yep.
a little channel that yep. would just barely fit the washer.
Yep.
And there were women that worked on the assembly line right near him and they would just chat all day and they could do it like they could just make the washer fit right into the channel like super easily. But if you, and they just had it down
yep.
and they could entertain themselves and each other. Here's my dad. He was like, if you don't get the washer in just right, then you have to muscle it in and you can really hurt your body
yeah, yeah.
doing it and the repetitive stress, but also how he used the words, like he wanted to kill himself. Like it was so boring, but it's the thing that eventually pushed him to, during his breaks, he would flip a cardboard box and make a makeshift desk and get his studies done.
Oh,
he would study.
I'm so glad there's a happy, productive.
But it was, you know, because he.
But he was studying to get a better job, a management.
Well,
or
actually, for skilled trades yeah. to be a skilled trade, somebody that you know wasn't necessarily working on the assembly line.
Yeah.
He ended up being an electrical engineer.
Yeah.
So that he would hold a body of knowledge.
There you go.
That was valued.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, this all is very relatable because when Henry Ford first introduced the assembly line process in his automobile factories, he literally could not get anyone to work for him.
Really?
The skilled mechanics showed up for the job, discovered they were being asked to specifically not use their knowledge and just screw in a bolt over and over again. They were appalled and literally wouldn't do it. He had to hire more than 900 people just to fill 100 roles because that's how many people walked out. They were like, oh, hell no.
No way, no day.
No way, no day.
I believe it.
These were men who were not only proud of their knowledge and skill, but they understood at a very, very deep level the satisfaction that they got from doing their work, from planning to problem solving to being in flow to using their hands to using their whole
yes,
bodies
yes.
to seeing their work complete. I mean, they knew how it feels to be proud of your work,
yeah.
to be satisfied with a job well done, and they knew the value of it. They were not going to stand in line and screw in a bolt.
Yes.
So, in order to keep people, Ford had to double the pay.
Interesting.
He didn't want to,
duh.
But he did.
Yeah.
And then a crazy thing happened. He discovered that doubling the pay was the best cost-cutting move he could ever have made.
How so, Laura Camion?
Well, people then stayed in those positions because it was too much to walk away from. And he inadvertently created what we now call the golden handcuffs phenomenon. Like
yeah.
people couldn't leave. This was reliable work
yes.
and a paycheck that they could count on
yeah.
rather than the unknown of being your own boss.
Yeah, Yep.
Interestingly enough, I won't go into this in great detail, but around this same time, the concept of personal debt was becoming a norm in our society, whereas it had been shunned previously.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yes. And it was all, it's all related, because then if you have personal debt, you can't leave a job like this.
Yeah.
So it's all working hand in hand. But this is how we began to inflate the importance of quote unquote knowledge workers. Essentially, you take the activity of a self-directed labor constructed by a skilled worker and you dissolve it, break it into parts, and reconstruct it and call it a process that's now controlled by management.
Mm.
So I think it's really, really interesting to think that it has only been 100 years since this concept really took off. Like, I feel like, well, this is the way work has always been done and this makes sense. But it's actually, it's only 100 years old. But here we are, back where we started, with people literally craving to work with their hands, to see the whole process and to feel the satisfaction of having made something real and tangible.
This is rocking my socks.
So, back to the author, Matthew Crawford. After working for years in this think tank,
yes,
he did the unthinkable. He quit and he opened his own motorcycle repair shop.
The unthinkable.
The yes. unthinkable.
Yes, motorcycle repair.
He loves it. He feels satisfied and proud of his work every day. And in this book, I think he does an incredible job of illustrating how the craft trades are anything but menial work.
Yes.
The problem solving that goes into designing or building something, the troubleshooting, the amount of knowledge and years of experience. When you hear an engine with a particular sound, if you have the knowledge and the experience, you know that could be one of three things.
Yes.
Right? And I just think about how grateful I am to have grown up with my dad and
yes.
watching him make things start to finish. I see him so vividly in my mind. Ugh. Like sketching out designs
yeah.
at the kitchen table.
100%.
I'd hear him discussing what type of wood would be best and why.
Yeah.
Spoiler, with my dad, it was almost always oak. He was an oak man.
Do you know why?
Loved it. Oak, all of it. He just loved work, the ease of working with it. It was solid. It was strong enough, but also
the fact that your father has an opinion that, that oak wood is the best wood is
loved,
delightful.
Loved.
I wish
loved.
I had a stronger wood
oh
opinion.
Oh my God. We'll talk about that. Cause now I'm a little like when I see teak or when I see rosewood,
yes.
like that were often used in the mid century, I'm like, ooh, I love that.
Zebra wood,
yeah.
like things with a, just like a, an
exotic
gray.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. But then I would see him measuring, cutting, sanding, staining, installing, like dad could do it all.
Oh man.
He's creative and technical and so detailed. And unfortunately, as a society, we seem to be doubling down on this knowledge worker path, like despite evidence that it isn't the reliable career path that it once was. Over the past 10 to 15 years, many of the manual trades are being cut from schools.
Mm.
And they assume that the knowledge careers will be a better option.
Ah.
And they see trade work as limiting the options for the person down the road.
But not necessarily so.
Not necessarily so. But our author also speculates that it might be something more than that that keeps people from working in the craft trades. And I was fascinated with this. So he describes the joy of seeing what you've made. It's tangible, and the process of creating it also has you focused on something outside of yourself. So he really talks a lot about like kind of the narcissism of being all in the thought careers where
uh-huh.
you're just thinking all the time. And he's like, this forces you, working with your hands forces you literally to be outside of yourself and focused on something besides you.
I hear that, but I also think there's something of, I don't know if narcissistic is the right word, but there is something about crafting something with your own hands that is sort of like, I am birthing this thing that is of
That's
me.
That's true too.
Yeah.
And I actually think he was totally misused. It was his word, narcissist, but
yeah.
I don't think you
yeah.
like catch narcissism like that. I think that's something else.
I've come down.
Excuse me. I think I'm all about me. Hold on. So I think, so in his belief that you're less inclined to overestimate your own importance when you're working with something with your hands, like you can see right away whether or not it's working, either it works or it doesn't. The car runs or it doesn't. You can see your successes right before your eyes, but you can also see your failures right before your eyes. This is what's so interesting to me. He speculates that some people don't want to see the concrete examples of whether their work, well, worked or not. And this is fascinating, I think. He talks about how in office jobs, the actual work is unclear. So the success or failure of that work and what each person is responsible for is so ambiguous that you don't feel the joy of success, and you also don't have to look at what isn't working or how you might have contributed to it. He writes, "Crucial to all this is actually experiencing failure, something white-collar workers are often buffered from. There are people who'll say, 'Oh, I'm not mechanical,' he says, but often much of what distinguishes people who are is that they're willing to undergo the experience of unambiguous failure." And I really love that unambiguous failure. It either works or it doesn't. Like if you bring a client in and you say, "I've fixed your motorcycle," and then they start the engine and it putters out, you obviously have not fixed the motorcycle. It's not ambiguous at all. And it takes a lot of confidence to work in an art form where there's no gray area.
This also sparks something in me, which is, have you ever been somewhere and you've met someone and you're like, "What do you do?" And they're like, "I own a motorcycle repair shop."
Yeah.
Or I, just something that is so, like, you can visualize that. You understand conceptually what that is.
Yeah.
Have you ever been somewhere where you've met someone and you're like, "What do you do?" And they're like, "Oh, so in futures trading, there's this technical," but like where they get into this very,
"What the hell are they doing?
What are you doing? And sometimes I see it as a failing on my part that I don't understand enough. To know, to be able to conceptualize how they spend their days. Maybe I'm just a simpleton, but I feel like I excel with things you can really conceptualize what it is or what you're making."
Yes.
And verbalize it.
Yeah.
In a way that, I don't know, maybe.
I think it's more satisfying. I think that
and I might be a bit of a simpleton, but
it's more satisfying when you know exactly what work you're doing and what you're contributing to it. And a lot of white collar work is contributing maybe ideas, but you don't know where you are in that chain of ideas.
So I work in actuary, but a very specific thing in actuary.
But I really took to this unambiguous failure thing too, because I have thought about, like, in certain office jobs that I've had, is it possible for people to lack accountability? Sure. No one knows who got credit for that or who should, you know, who should be saying sorry about that idea, because it's a big old mixing pot and you're just sort of like, "I was in there. I did something. What did I contribute to it?"
Yeah.
But I really latched onto this idea though about there is a vulnerability to working on a trade where it's really clear.
Works or doesn't.
If you're stretching leather over a saddle, it either fits or it doesn't. Uh-huh. And you'll be, you know, if you did not
cut it and stretch it correctly,
then whoops, that's on you. And you have, you know what I mean? Like, there's something very real about it. And I liked his boldness, basically, and his confidence of saying, like, if you have the balls to work in these fields, you're confronting success and failure all day long.
Just it also reminds me of those people that do have 10 million hours doing, whether it's stretching leather over a saddle, whether it's a Chuck Wilmarth painting signs, like there's something, I don't know. I always attribute it to me being a simpleton, but I do find it incredibly, it's more satisfying for me when I can wrap my brain around something that someone does or something that I do.
I do not believe, and after this spark, like, I hope you examine that simpleton idea, because I don't believe that's true. I believe it is a basic human craving to feel the tangible results of your work, to be able to see it and feel it. And there's something incredibly satisfying to that. It's not about being simple. I think it's a basic human need. And despite like all the decisions that schools and government is making, there's no doubt that more people are moving toward their desire to be makers, whether it be their career or their hobby, than ever before. So like I said, we've only been at this particular way of working for 100 years. And at least in the last 10 to 15, there's been a measurable movement back towards like the skilled crafts and trades.
Yeah.
According to European CEO, the value of goods bought on Etsy jumped last year to 3.3 billion from just 1 million the first year they started.
Gosh.
And according to them, millennials are driving the trend. They said millennials like to express their individuality by buying one-of-a-kind items. Plus, artisan goods are often local goods made by small businesses. And whether it's like artisan or handcrafted breads, cheese, beer, millennials want to know like where their food is coming from. And I think that's a really positive thing.
That's a good metaphor. I want to know where my food is coming from.
There you go.
When somebody talks about, when somebody like winds up to tell me what their job is and they're like, it's kind of like, boy, how excited do I get when they succeed at describing something that was very esoteric job.
Yeah.
But it is. I want to know where my food is coming from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think there's a lot of hope about the demand for skilled labor. Like we might be moving away from the mass produced products. We might be moving away from this assumption that just, you know, factory created things are what everyone wants. And that same article said, as for the makers, the time spent away from screens in today's high-tech world is a bigger draw. They said that they referred to it as high touch versus high tech.
Yes.
It's tactile.
Yes.
And at a time when people are increasingly spending their days in front of tablets, laptops, and computer screens, high touch activities present an opportunity to do something more physical. Engrossing oneself in an engaging activity is relaxing, and the resulting product creates a sense of pride and ownership. And I think there's so many of us who are craving a job with meaning, right? With purpose. And I don't remember my dad ever talking about the need for that because
he had it.
I think he had it.
Yeah.
Between his teaching and coaching and working with his hands, like he always had a smile on his face and a certain contentment that I think we're all looking for. And he still has that, by the way. So, Suze, when I was home, I found a pile of my old journals. And boy, that's a spark for another day.
Whoa.
But I found, hold on.
Oh my God.
In this book right here.
Oh no.
I probably met you when I was writing in this book, to be honest.
95, 96?
Yeah. Okay. 96, I think.
Yeah.
So I found in here a poem for my dad that I wrote when I was 25 years old, right in here. I remember the day. I remember the moment. I was living in New York City.
Oh my God, my mouth will not shut. It's so agog.
I remember walking through a subway station and they were building something somewhere and I smelt the varnish and the memories of my dad just hit me
time machine.
Yeah, as they always do when I'm around a wood shop or anything that looks or smells like woodworking. I'm like,
yes, I love it.
So don't go too hard on my 25-year-old poet self.
Nothing but love.
But this is what I wrote for my father. 1997 is when I wrote this.
Amazing.
The smell of varnish always stops me in my tracks. I stand frozen, allowing the inevitable flood, memories of my father. I close my eyes. I can hear the saw blade and the sandpaper. I see his strong hands toiling over every corner, joint, and notch. A passion for his work, his love can be felt in the perfection of the details. That same attention to detail permeates my life. His voice in my ear brings a smile to my face. You don't apologize for fouling in a game of basketball. and you don't socialize on the starting line. He makes me laugh at myself. Even now, when I am tired, though not from the 400 meters, I hear him clearly, pick up your feet. And I do. I picture him, solid as an oak, the image of vitality brimming with life. A smile for every stranger, a hearty chuckle when you just have to laugh. I remember the loving pats on my back, chin up, Lulu, the twinkle in his eyes, his reassurance that if you smile a lot when you're young, you'll have wrinkles in all the right places. Those words have stayed with me long enough to realize he was right. And his love has stayed with me during years of wandering, looking for my own opinions, my own way, my own self. A lonely journey, but he stayed patient, knowing I'd come home. Now standing, surrounded by the smell of varnish and someone else's handiwork, I store these memories of my father. I hold them tight, hoping he can feel me hold him from 1,500 miles away. It's taken me 25 years to get to know this man, but every moment I have loved him, a history of who I am. So that was for my dad.
Oh, I love it. Cameron, I love it.
That was for my dad. And he, like, I gave it to him that year. I remembered
you
framed
did.
It.
Yep. You did.
He kept it
you
proudly on his
it.
Wall. Mm-hmm.
Did you print it on a computer?
I hand wrote it.
You hand wrote it in your beautiful handwriting.
Oh, you do. It was back then, actually. Way back when. And I put a picture of us in there.
Oh.
And then this is hard for me to say, but even then, like, my dad asked me to, like, years after, he's had it on his wall for a few years. And then he's like, I hope you know, like, I have it. I've talked to Julie and I have it in my will. Like, I want you to read that at my funeral.
Oh, boy.
And I was like, oof. I don't know, Dad. I don't know. Just because
you,
this is what yeah. you're going to get right
That's
here.
That's okay. That's okay. That's
but
quality
if he,
right there,
if
baby.
He wants me to, I will, of course. Yeah. I would happily do anything for
what
him.
An amazing thing to know from your father, the recipient of, you know, your beautiful self-expression, that he feels like that represents him in a strong enough way that it memorializes him living yeah. or not living.
I was pretty proud of that.
That's pretty good.
He is awesome, honestly. Like, he's just an incredible, incredible guy. And I also know from so many people how he touched their lives as yeah. a coach. And that just makes me so
you
proud.
You must be so know? Proud. And also, again, not to objectify your father, but just what a sex pot.
I'll show you some more pictures. But he, yeah, he was super.
He's super special.
Yeah, he's
super special.
So awesome. And yeah, I feel like I wish I would have learned more about the particular, you know, his trade of woodworking.
But guess like what? Mm-hmm. Story's not over yet.
That's right. So what
Story's
do we make
over.
Of this?
What do we make of it?
My answer is all the things. Make all the things. Like, first of all, if you want to make things, if you're having that craving
yes.
to make things with your hands,
yes.
listen to it, follow it, do it.
This is helping me form a finer distinction. I know that in the course of a day well-lived, a week well-lived, a month, a year well-lived for me, there is a bit of a lot of different things. And some of it is reading, researching, thinking. Some of it is writing. So like real thinky,
yeah.
creative,
yes.
self-expressed
yeah.
thinky work. But another thing is makey work. Like
yeah.
like words to the side, paints out, scissors, tools. Nathan, do you remember where the painting sponges are? Like just like
where is that?
There's that... That yeah. is such a, and I try at this point in my life, I have to steal time and sneak it
yeah.
in. It's one of the reasons I love the creativity challenge because it gives me a built-in excuse to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that I feel like for me in a life well lived, there is some measure of balance of
yeah.
the, like, I love the reading and the thinking and the writing yeah. and the researching. I do
sure.
love that self-expression.
Yeah.
But there is something about making stuff with my hands that
yes.
brings me some of that creative, meditative, flow state satisfaction.
I think for me, this book made me realize how false the belief is that there's like knowledge-based work.
Yeah.
And then there's like skilled labor work.
Mm.
The fact of the matter is skilled labor work includes all the thinking, planning, scheming, measuring, all of that. Whereas the knowledge-based work, it doesn't include the hands-on work.
True.
So I'm a little bit like, I've been sold a bill of goods here. And for the makers, they have, to me, the lack of value that our culture has put on what is extremely high level thinking and extremely high level doing combined.
Mm-hmm. Well, you think about the work that your father was doing that required mathematics and planning and creative visualization and all of this to build a house where a house did not exist before, to build a roll top desk it did not exist before.
Amazing.
The amount of different parts of your brain that have to light up to get that thing made sitting in the living room.
That's right.
Or the living room, sitting in the living room that you built. Like, it's extraordinary.
It's truly amazing.
And I love that we have people in our lives, people that we love, who are keeping the dream alive.
That's
whether
right.
it's your brother, whether it's Nathan.
Yeah.
This is sort of, Nathan is, he loves to learn how to do things. He has a lot of areas of like mastery. I love this about him.
Yeah.
Over the holiday, I put a picture up of him. He had bought years and years and years and years and years and years and years ago an Amiga 500 computer.
Yes.
And he's been carrying it, moving it. It arrived and it didn't work.
Yep.
And he's been carrying it from apartment to home just for years. And he got that thing up and running over the
holiday. That is amazing.
And
he's so incredible.
When I hear the tune... the tunes coming out of that Amiga 500, the amount of thought, that complex thought that went into those hands, getting that thing up and running.
That's right.
It gives me a lady boner. I'm sorry. I love it. I love it. What else do we make of it?
I can't believe. I was going to have my dad listen to this episode, but now it says lady boner in it.
You know what? Your father has lived through a lot. He can handle... me saying lady boner and calling him sexy.
I think you're right.
I think so, you're right.
So personally, I have regrets about not learning my dad's trade. I love him so much and I'm so proud of him as a craftsman. I do want to commit to learning to do more with my hands this year, learning a skill and improving on it. But my hope is that, you know, anyone, if you've been hesitating or if you had in your mind that somehow doing that work wasn't, you know, valuable in any way, like, please reconsider that thought.
I have an idea.
Yeah.
Here's my idea.
Yeah.
And I talked to Nathan about this over the holiday during the creativity challenge.
Yeah.
I asked Nathan if he would be willing to, teach me, and I'm going to, if you want to, bring you in on this.
Yeah.
To teach us how to do some basic things with power tools.
Ooh,
so
yes.
How to cut things with a jigsaw, how to, you name it.
Yep.
Just things that are, how to properly use the drill driver in the drill, like things that are just a little past my area of expertise.
You got this.
You've got it too.
Yeah.
Like maybe we could find a project, a woodworking project, and have Nathan teach us what we need to know.
Fine.
To make it.
Yes.
Whether that's something, maybe it's something that your dad still has some of that curriculum. Like maybe it's a magazine holder. Maybe it's a
They
clock.
Used to make in class, they would make like... picture frames, obviously, start with that. And then they would make jewelry boxes. And then they would move on to like more advanced things. But at the end of every semester, Dad would be like, come on up to the shop. We've got some unclaimed jewelry boxes. You take what you want. So I probably have, you know, like in my lifetime.
17 unclaimed jewelry boxes.
17, like, you got to imagine they weren't the most perfectly done because those people, claimed theirs. They were like, I was making this for my mom. It's her Christmas gift. And so they came and got theirs. But then there were a bunch of people like, ah, I don't want that jewelry box.
Wah, wah.
So
that's the one you got.
We always got a selection of them.
Oh, Cams, I love this spark so much.
Thanks. I want to hear yours.
That is a great spark. Let's take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll spark it.
The spark fire!
Oh my gosh, Cams, that spark.
Aww.
I-L-O-V-E-D, that spark.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh.
I just want to point out, like, so in all the journals that I found, I'm sure there'll be other sparks that I uncover, but I found a journal that marked the day that we met. It was a leather-bound New York Times, like, calendar year 1996. And on June 6th, it said, perform at Diverse Works, which is where I was performing at Renee Rolleri's art show.
You sure were.
At that show, after I performed, you made a beeline. I saw you.
Because I know quality.
Because you know quality. And you were like, hello. You're amazing. We need to know each other.
Can you believe me? I feel like when I get excited about someone, I did the same thing that Maida Wagner. When I get excited about someone, I like tackle them.
It was awesome. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I was like breathlessly. Like that was the first time I had, It was the first time I performed for people that I knew in New York. I had done other shows, but for no one who knew me. So no big deal. And the shows weren't good enough for me to tell anyone to go to. Yeah. They would be like, you're in a show. And I'm like, no, please don't.
I do remember the moment
please
we met.
Don't.
I do remember
but
that.
Then, Susan, so then I flipped the page and on that Monday, so that was like a Friday night. And then that Monday I had written in there, Susan Blackwell called, exclamation. She wants me to perform at
Talent show. Yeah. I used to curate a monthly talent show essentially at the Cornelia Street Cafe. May she rest in peace.
And Fred Armisen performed at that very same one.
He sure did. Mm-hmm. As among many others. Future rock stars.
But I just couldn't believe I saw right there the date, the moment memorialized.
How about that?
Mm-hmm.
June 6th?
June 6th was when we met. No, June 3rd was when we met. When I performed at Diverse Works,
we should mark that on our
calendar. June 6th is your
friendiversary.
Your friendiversary.
June 3rd. I love it.
Okay, awesome.
Okay, great.
Yay, old journals.
Yay, old journals. What a spark source. So my spark sources for this spark are an email from a podcast listener and workshop attendee, the book Quiet by Susan Cain, a TED Talk by Susan Cain, and an article in Vanity Fair by Julie Miller. This spark started for me from an email that came from our workshop participant, Christine Cornish Smith. Christine is a seasoned Broadway performer, been in several Broadway shows, and this email came within 24 hours of our workshop.
Christine!
Yeah, it bears mentioning that in the workshop, I mentioned in passing that I am an introvert who totally presents like an extrovert, and that having that language and saying that sentence has been a journey to just have that understanding and speak out. But back to Christine's email. She wrote, first off, it goes without saying, I feel absolutely on fire.
Fire.
The workshop just really ignited something in me. I can't thank you enough for that gift. We are so lucky. Sparks flying. Thanks,
aww,
Christine. That was a hot workshop. It was really, really,
great.
If we do say so ourselves, it was really good. I wanted to ask how you so gracefully seem to cope with being an introvert in this business. I've struggled with it some, feeling like I let people down when I feel alive and free being funny and outward on stage or in a productive setting, but then really don't respond well to being around people all the time, / entertaining people, / being the life of the party. So I find I can be a total recluse sometimes. I'm trying to find a balance. And I am, slowly, but I just wondered if you have any words of wisdom being in this industry as an introvert. Okay, that's all. Again, thank you. Aww. Very, very excited to continue to invest in the Spark File. That's right. We're having an IPO. We're opening it up to investors. Just
that's
kidding.
That's right.
She says, it's the real deal. Love, Christine.
Oh, how sweet.
Christine.
Your
question.
A joy.
As a person.
Yeah.
What a joy.
What a joy.
What a bucket of sunshine.
And this question.
This question is such a good question. Mm. And I wrote back, I spent a long while tortured by the fact that there were many social and work situations that I felt resistant to because of exposure to lots of people or unfamiliar people. Obviously, I like to think of myself as socially adept, but if it wasn't mandatory, I often didn't want to participate. It made me feel, I don't know, off or damaged or something. So to overcome it, I would push myself and schedule myself day and night and day and night, always going, always grinding, always exhausted. Then I heard a woman named Susan Cain speak at a conference where we were both presenting. It was an ideation summit at Walt Disney Imagineering, because you know what? That's how I roll. During the course of Susan's talk, she described several of the dimensions of introversion and then asked the audience who saw themselves in her descriptions. It was like the top of, I've said this before, but it's those moments I have where it's like the top of my head lifted off and a rainbow shot straight into the sky. Susan Cain was so clearly describing me, but I could barely believe it. How could it be possible that with this high visibility career and loving people as I do, that I could be an introvert?
Wow.
Which leads me to my spark today, introversion.
Oh,
as I said,
wow.
My major spark sources are the woman who is Susan Cain, her book, which is entitled Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, and her amazing TED Talk. So as I told Dear Christine, when I first heard Susan Cain speak, it was a giant spark for me. And if y'all are listening to this and you are so moved, I highly encourage you to check out her work.
Highly.
But in the meantime, I want to share some gems from her work that have really sparked me.
Awesome.
Before I begin, I want to provide this disclaimer. All of this reminded me of our conversation with Anthony Vinicielli of Freestyle Love Supreme. He was saying, and I want to echo, that it can be very reductive to make it black or white, either or introvert or extrovert.
Yep.
It's even more complex than introvert, ambivert, extrovert. There are more complexities and distinctions contained in all of this. And to further complicate matters, the definitions of what introversion is and what extroversion is differ depending on the source. But since she literally wrote the book on it, when I'm talking about this topic, I'm going to be referring to Susan Cain's definitions unless I say otherwise. So let's start there.
Got it.
One distinction Susan points out in her TED Talk is that introversion is not shyness.
Uh-huh.
She defines shyness as fear of social judgment.
Uh-huh.
Okay. She says introversion is more about how one responds to stimulation, including social stimulation. By her definition, extroverts crave large amounts of stimulation, whereas introverts feel at their most alive and their most switched on and their most capable when they're in quieter, more low-key environments. She stipulates that these things aren't absolute, but they are at play much of the time. So the key then to maximizing our talents is for us all to put ourselves in the zone of stimulation that's right for us. And I'd also like to mention that Zone of Stimulation is my new anthology of erotica. Now sold.
I was literally going to say, is that a sex book? Oh my God.
Now not available wherever fine books are sold. So in her book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, Susan Cain provides a series of 20 true or false questions that can help you discern where you fall on the spectrum.
Mm.
I want to share a few of those questions with you. So if you're playing along at home, you can start getting a sense or maybe even confirming your suspicions about where you fall.
Okay.
So answer each question, true or false, choosing the answer that applies to you more often than not. This isn't the whole list. You can go get Susan Cain's book to read that. Cams, you want to take a mini quiz?
I do.
Here we go.
I'm ready.
I prefer one-on-one conversations to group activities.
One-on-one.
So true. I often prefer to express myself in writing.
True.
I dislike small talk, but I enjoy talking in depth about topics that matter to me.
True.
People tell me that I'm a good listener.
True.
People describe me as soft-spoken or mellow.
Sometimes.
Except when you're like, meh. I prefer not to show or discuss my work with others until it's finished.
Yeah.
I dislike conflict.
Yeah.
I tend to think before I speak.
Oh, always.
I feel drained after being out and about, even if I've enjoyed myself.
Oh, for God's sakes, yes.
I often let calls go through to voicemail.
That's unfair. I can't say that publicly. That is correct.
And if I had to choose, I'd prefer a weekend with absolutely nothing to do to one with too many things scheduled.
It's true. But I want to say not all these things have always been true of me.
That's
but
right.
I feel true sure. in
yeah.
this moment.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
So
Because and some of them more than others.
These things are not necessarily fixed.
That's right.
And there's a lot of, you know. Okay, so the more often...
That was cruel. That was a really cruel joke.
But this is like the experience I had listening to Susan Cain speak.
Oh, yeah,
I could believe myself.
Yeah.
According to Susan, the more often you answered true, the more introverted you probably are. And if you found yourself with roughly an equal number of true and false answers, then you may be an ambivert. Yes, that is actually a word. Mm-hmm. So if you're playing along at home, how you doing?
How are you doing?
Does it confirm your suspicions? I think we have your answer, Cams.
Yeah.
From Susan Cain's TED Talk. When she was growing up, she said that reading was the primary group activity in their home. And that may sound antisocial, but it was really just a different way of being social. She said, and I love this more than I can tell you, you have the animal warmth of your family sitting right next to you, but you're also free to go roaming around the adventure land inside your own mind. Isn't that the best?
That is awesome.
I do love that. Then she gives an example how that was challenged. She went to summer camp and she was encouraged not to read all the books she had packed, but to be outgoing and rowdy.
That's right.
Her fellow campers and very well-meaning camp counselors wanted to see that camp spirit. She cites that as just as one of the many times she got the message that somehow her bookish, quiet, introverted style of being was not necessarily the right way to go, and that she should be trying to pass as more of an extrovert.
Susan, I've been on vacations where I brought a book and thought, like, if I'm on a beach, I want to be A, under an umbrella, and B, reading a book.
Yeah.
And I've just had those experiences where people are like, why are you reading? What are you doing? What? Okay, rude, reading. Like, it, all these different responses. And I'm just sort
Who
of like...
Who are you vacationing with? Jesus
I'm just
Christ.
Saying in the past that has happened.
Ay-yay-yay.
Does not happen now. But it has happened in the past. And I'm just like, wow, the visceral responses to my reading. Why is it bothering you so much?
Yeah.
But I relate to what she's saying. Like, because it's a reflection on how they think you should be.
Yeah. So she cites the summer camp experience as one of the many times she got the message that this way of being was not necessarily the right way to go.
Yeah.
And she said she always sensed deep down that that was wrong and that introverts were pretty excellent just as they were. Still, even with that low voice assuring her that her authentic introverted style was completely valid, instead of immediately becoming a writer, which is what she dreamed of doing, she pushed herself to become a Wall Street lawyer. And instead of having quiet dinners with friends that she would have preferred, she found herself in noisy bars. She had internalized the bias towards extroversion and was trying to embody it, which I feel like I have done.
Oh, yeah.
And I think you have done too, Cams.
Yes, indeed.
Back to her TED Talk. Susan illustrated how in many of our institutions, our schools, our workplaces, they are designed mostly for extroverts and for extroverts need for lots of stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in modern times, your typical classroom has pods of desks with several students all facing each other, and they are assigned a lot of group assignments and work. And for the kids who prefer to go off by themselves or just to work alone, those students are seen sometimes as outliers or worse, as problem cases.
Mm-hmm.
And she went on to say that according to research, the vast majority of teachers report believing that the ideal student is an extrovert as opposed to an introvert, even though introverts actually get better grades and are more knowledgeable, which I have to say, I get. As a teacher, you want that good classroom discussion, but those who are apt to speak easily in a group setting aren't necessarily the brightest thinkers. They're just the ones who are more comfortable talking out loud in a group. But it reminds me, Cam.
It's so simple when you say it like that.
Cams, it reminds me of that thing. We've talked about it on the podcast. You have said it for as long as I have known you, back when I met you on June 6th. The gene that makes you a great artist is not the same gene that makes you a great networker or a great connector. But sometimes the person who is the most charismatic salesperson rises to the top of the industry because of their That's comfort right. and ability to summon attention to themselves. Susan Cain, in her book, cites that there is no correlation between the people with the best ideas and the people who are the best presenters. And I just want to shout it from the rooftops until they come and arrest me and drag me down to Bellevue. That is, I just think... I've been lucky that I've had you in my ear for years saying that.
Suze.
But research.
But the takeaway from that is like, if you are not good at touting your work, this does not make you less of an artist. If you are great at touting your work, it doesn't make you a better artist.
It just may make you a better representative.
That's
for
right.
Your art.
Yeah. It's just different skills.
Yeah. She says the same concept is true in our workplaces. When it comes to leadership, introverts are routinely passed over for leadership positions. She cites research by Adam Grant at the Wharton School, who found that introverted leaders often deliver better outcomes than extroverts do because when they're managing proactive employees, they're much more likely to let those employees run with their mm-hmm. ideas. Mm-hmm. Whereas an extrovert can almost subconsciously get so excited about things that they're putting their own stamp on them and other people's ideas might not as easily bubble to the surface. Basically, there's not as much space for those people and their ideas.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And that's not even touching the whole point of like credit and,
yes,
and that
not
kind
even
of
touching
thing.
It.
We won't touch it. We'll leave it right there.
She also mentions open office plans, which struck this thing in me. I remember when I was still working in corporate, I actually still love the look of open plan offices. The polished concrete floors, you throw in a little fireball orange in there into the design scheme or some
exposed
like
brick wall.
Some neon yellow. I love the look of open plan. And then I worked in an open plan office and I could not sustain it. I lasted about 6 months in an open plan office. And though there were significant considerations in my life that led me to leave that job, I was shocked at how difficult it was for me to thrive in an open plan environment. It was so loud. I just wanted to be able to put my back to a wall and close a door, not to demonstrate my superiority corner office style, but to be able to relax.
That's right.
And focus and concentrate.
Quiet.
And get work done.
Amen.
It really was Amen. Shocking how problematic it was for
it's
me.
It's so hard. And then you just want to say, I just want to be productive. I want to do the work.
I do.
I just need an environment where I can do
it. It was tough.
Yeah, that's rough.
Susan shared how some of our greatest leaders throughout history have been introverts. People like Abraham Lincoln, Steven Spielberg, Bill Gates, Eleanor Roosevelt, Rosa Parks, Gandhi, how these people describe themselves as quiet, soft-spoken, even shy, and how they took those leadership positions, even though every bone in their body was telling them not to. They took them because they were driven to do what they thought was right. And just to expand on that for a moment, we can be true blue introverts, but as we were saying earlier, it's not necessarily a fixed trait. When we are moved by love or professionalism, and I think this is what Christine was keying into, it's how I personally can appear extroverted when I'm passionate about something that mm-hmm. I'm teaching or speaking about.
Mm-hmm.
And when I love my students or my audience,
100%,
I am happy to attend or even throw a party for people I love. And right before the party, I typically have this feeling where I'm like, I know almost every party you've ever been to that I've thrown, you can be guaranteed that that day I was like, why did I do this? I don't want to do this party feeling. But the love carries me through the event. And then once I'm there, I don't want anybody to ever leave.
Yeah.
Back to these amazing introverted leaders. They all took the spotlight, even though their introverted nature may have been telling them not to. And Susan Cain says this turns out to have a special power all its own because people could feel that these leaders were at the helm, not because they enjoyed directing others, mm-hmm. and not out of the pleasure of being looked at. They were there because they had no choice. They were driven by their love for their work or country or people and their professionalism.
Nice. So that makes so much sense.
Yeah. Let's hear from some introverts who have excelled as a result mm-hmm. of their love and professionalism. Amy Schumer, from her book, The Girl with the Lower Back Tattoo, which is the greatest book title ever, second only to my book of erotica, Zone of whatever it was. I don't remember. These are Amy Schumer's words.
I've gone around the bend.
Good. I love it when you're around the bend. Okay, here's Amy Schumer. I am, without a doubt, a classic textbook introvert. Being an introvert doesn't mean you're shy. It means you enjoy being alone. Not just enjoy it, you need it. There's a National Geographic photo I love of a young brown bear. He's sitting peacefully against a tree near the border of Finland and Russia. The caption reads something like, "The cubs played feverishly all day, and then one of them left the group for a few minutes to relax on his own and enjoy the quiet." This was very meaningful to me because that's what I do. Except in my case, the bear gets ripped away from his chill spot by the tree, and several people paint his face and curl his hair and put him in a dress so he can be pushed on stage to ride one of those tiny bicycles in the circus. I'm not saying he doesn't enjoy making people laugh, but still, it's hard out there for a fuzzy little introvert. It might be surprising for you to learn that most of my days are spent alone, unless I am on set, which is crazy draining for an introvert. As soon as lunchtime arrives, I skip the food service tables and rush to my trailer or quiet corner and I meditate. I need to completely shut off. This time spent silently is like food to me. It wasn't until I became best friends with some fellow comics and performers that I realized being an introvert wasn't a character flaw. Mm-hmm. Now that I know I'm an introvert, I can better manage this quality and actually start to see it as a positive. Just because my job requires me to make fun of myself into a microphone and wear my heart on my sleeve for hire doesn't mean I can't be an introvert as well.
That is true.
Amy motherfucking Schumer.
Amy motherfucking Schumer.
Getting shit done.
Oh my God.
Getting great shit done. Being a hilarious out in front, you know, executive producer, leading performer.
Activist.
Yeah.
I mean, she's loud
Activist.
And proud.
She sure is.
I think it's also got to be more challenging when you are a person who's in the spotlight. The judgments and the false narratives that people can create around you going to your trailer for lunch and not talking to anyone.
Right. That's
You're
right.
like, my God, they, you know, just need a moment of peace
this
and quiet.
This actually brings me to my next example.
Good. I was trying to get you there.
Nice setup. Meryl Streep.
That one doesn't surprise me as much.
Well, it doesn't surprise
it pleases me.
Not to
know.
I had a very small part in a very big movie called The Post.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I remember Meryl Streep had her chair was sort of like her folding chair was sort of set a bit away and kind of she had like a little cubby, like a little privacy cubby.
Yeah.
You could still see her, but she was like, you know, doing her own thing.
Yeah.
And I had an innate sense of like, let us respect that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it makes sense to me that she's an introvert. This is from an article in Vanity Fair, and she's talking about her mom.
Yeah.
"I'm much more of an introvert than my mother. I'm much more inclined to want to not say anything in public. Mm. When I have to be in the spotlight, I think to myself, Mary Streep could do it. It's a good thing to imagine yourself doing something you think you can't. I do that every day because basically, if I had my way, I just stay home and think about what I'm having for supper." And I deeply relate to that, but I think that Meryl Streep is another example of somebody who, when there is love or professionalism afoot, she reaches past her introversion and she gets the job
done.
She's
high functioning.
Yeah, she's high functioning. In her book, Susan Cain wrote this about the great civil rights legend, Rosa Parks. "I had always imagined Rosa Parks as a stately woman with a bold temperament, someone who could easily stand up to a busload of glowering passengers. But when she died in 2005, at the age of 92, the flood of obituaries recalled her as soft-spoken, sweet, and small in stature. They said she was timid and shy, but had the courage of a lion. They were full of phrases like radical humility and quiet fortitude. And in fact, Parks titled her autobiography, Quiet Strength."
I love that so much.
How about it?
That just resonates so much with me because like there's been a few times in my life where I'm sure more than I'm even aware of, but a couple of times when it was very, very made clear to me that someone thought that I could be walked on, you know, or a doormat because of my
introverted
thoughtful
tendency. Yes.
Yeah. And the way I think before I speak.
Yes.
And
yes.
I remember being like, and a lion comes out and people are just like, oh. And I'm like, that's right. Do not mistake my kindness for weakness.
Yes.
My kindness is a choice that frankly, I give to myself because I feel better when I have behaved in a certain way, you know?
Yeah.
And I just, that resonated for me, this idea that like from within, you know, that is not a woman who is going to be walked on. She made it clear, you know, she doesn't
any
need to
of those
go
women,
around.
Like,
they don't need to go around like beating their chests and showing their power.
These are formidable, powerful people.
That's right.
Getting shit done.
Yeah.
And they're introverts.
In a quiet way, if possible, but if provoked,
yeah,
they'll, you know, they'll step up.
That's right. All of them will rip it up. Okay. So what do we make of this? If you're Susan Cain, you research it, you study it, you make a whole essentially movement out of it. I feel like she really has with her Quiet Leadership Institute.
Yep.
And she is going into companies and teaching people the power of introverts and how introverts and extroverts can really thoughtfully work together to make our shared spaces more betterer.
Yeah, I think that is, I mean, that's the goal, right? And that it can be not that one is good and one is bad, but it doesn't also have to be that the world is built for only one kind.
That's correct.
And not the other.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. If you're an introvert, something I've done, as I've mentioned throughout my entire life, is challenge my introversion just enough to stay in the mix. For me, something that has worked, this is something I started doing. I remember doing it probably in high school, but especially in college. I would sort of kick myself in the ass a little bit to put my hand up first,
mm-hmm.
and to habituate risk taking in those ways, especially in relation to things that I loved and or was passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like Meryl Streep, imagining the model of someone who could do it and then challenging myself to step into it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a teacher, a facilitator, a leader, a director, any type of leader, you can educate yourself about all the dimensions surrounding, and it's a fun thing. I found it fun to dig into. You can educate yourself about all the dimensions surrounding introversion, ambiversion, extroversion, and implement ways to keep your classrooms, your boardrooms, your institutions, and your groups balanced to make sure that you're setting people up for success and getting the most out of everyone. And again, I beg of you to remember, the hand that is the quickest to habitually punch into the air isn't necessarily attached to the person who has the most insightful thoughts. And there are strategies for balancing the introversion and extroversion in the room so you're getting the best out of everybody.
Word.
If you're me, and maybe Christine Cornish Smith and Laura Camion, you create a life that is in alignment with your nervous system. You stop castigating yourself for feeling the way you feel about social situations. You give yourself permission to need extra recovery time after big social or professional output. You understand your personal makeup and structure a life that supports and celebrates it instead of just making yourself low grade wrong all the time. You understand that you can stretch past your innate introversion when you love something or when professionalism is at play. If you're a writer or like a choreographer, it's another way to or an actor, it's another way to understand character. I've got a lot of, what do we make of this?
I love it. I love the spark.
If you're a person in relationship to other people, it's a way to understand others. I remember doing a project with a very well-known extroverted person, and they were going through a separation from their partner. And because I'm an introvert, I prefer deeper conversations to chit chat, which I find draining. So for instance, I like to ask people who have been in relationships for a long time what they think their core conflict is. Like, I think I did this with Julianne Moore and Bart Freundlich on set. I was like, hey,
you did.
What's your core conflict? Yeah. And spoiler, she's fast and he's slow. But they're making it work.
I love that they can define it so clearly.
It was super clear. They had given it a lot of thought. So this person I was working with, at the core of the divide in their relationship was that they were extroverted and their partner was introverted, but they didn't know that.
Whoa.
But I could see it. This person I was working with expressed their exasperation that when they and their partner, for instance, would go to see some theater, that when the lights came up at the end of the show, their partner couldn't get out of the theater fast enough and couldn't get home fast enough. While the person I was working with wanted to go backstage and connect with the cast and chit chat. And they perceived their partner's desire to dash out as rejection of them and their whole career choice and their lifestyle. And I was like, give me other examples. And the more that they shared, the more I was like, No. Uh-huh. They're not rejecting you, your career, and your lifestyle. Uh-huh. It's just that you're an extrovert. Your partner is an introvert. And once you know that, it can really help you understand yourself and those you love, and maybe even, I don't know, save your marriage.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just like, no.
Interesting.
It's not, they're not rejecting you. They are tapped out.
Yeah. But like, if you don't know why.
That's right. You can ascribe any story to it. Totally to your point earlier that. About if Amy Schumer does not eat with the cast and crew and goes to meditate in her trailer, you can make up a story about that.
Yep.
And it's not a story about introversion. It's a story about hierarchy. Yep. And
That's correct.
Yep. But this goes, all of this goes for collaborators too. Sometimes when there is a mix of introverts, ambiverts, and extroverts, that can make for the best possible blend of collaborators or teammates. But to start with, you just need to do a little research, know a little bit more about it, and understand each other more.
I was going to say the key to that seems to be, and I've worked in many different groups, collaborations, there can be a tendency for people to believe that others need to be more like them. So like, let's say I believe I'm good at something. In order for me to believe that you are also good at it, you need to do it in a way that looks like the way I do it.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to being able to look over at you and say, oh my gosh, Susan has a totally different approach to that. Look, and it's amazing. And Susan is great at the way she does that, different from the way I do my thing. Mm-hmm. And I've been in so many groups where people weren't able to recognize how amazing the other people's skills were because they didn't have the same skills.
Mm.
And I'm like, we've got to see the difference in skills as a strengthening of the whole team, as opposed to...
Here's something that I'm kind of pulling up out of my butt. But yeah, Adam,
I like the things that come out of your butt. What?
Something that I came across as I was researching for this is that in many situations, likeness does make for a better team. Likeness.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
One outlier to that is introversion, ambiversion, extroversion.
Interesting.
Because there are strengths that each of those people that possess those, you know, there are strengths and weaknesses that they bring to the table. And it can be one area where difference creates a better team.
That makes sense.
Does that make sense? Okay.
I just think the key is what you said at first, which is people recognizing that.
You have to have a little more information.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know who provides that information?
Susan Cain.
Motherfucking Cain. a tangent. Susan Cain, I was listening. I've heard her. I love her. And I've read everything and I've listened to everything. And I just adore what she's doing in the world and her. She's just a great person. And I was listening to her TED talk in preparation for this again for the millionth time. And I was like, who does Susan Cain sound like? And I was shutting my eyes and I was like, who is it? So let me like jump to the chase when you all listen to her TED talk. She has shades of Lisa Kudrow.
Oh, wow.
She doesn't look like her.
Okay.
But shut your eyes and just imagine that Phoebe is giving you that TED talk. So jumping around. So as I mentioned, I first heard Susan speak at Walt Disney Imagineering. And afterwards, I really wanted to talk to her. But there was this scrum of very excited people surrounding her. And in true introvert fashion, I was like, I'm not messing with all that mess. And then as I was leaving the hotel the following day, I'm wheeling my little suitcase to get to the car to go to the airport. And there is Susan, bless her, motherfucking Cain, tucked. She's just sitting on this beautiful little bench surrounded by like beautiful greenery and flowers, overlooking this beautiful vista, just quietly working away. And it was the perfect way for me to meet her.
Oh.
It's the perfect way for me to meet anyone, frankly. One-on-one, quiet setting.
Sitting on a bench.
I felt so lucky to talk with Susan Cain afterwards and to tell her how much her work had meant to me. And I read her book and I took in everything Susan Cain had to give me. And then jumping back to my email with Christine Cornish-Smith. Christine, this one goes out to you. I want to tell you that learning what Susan Cain taught me about introversion has given me such peace. Like so many other fine distinctions we can know and understand about ourselves, like what kind of artist are we? What drives us? What moves us? What's our purpose? Do we respond better to internal or external accountability, et cetera, et cetera? It helped me to accept that I am an introvert who has stretched myself when motivated by love and or professionalism. Knowing this has made me feel great about giving keynotes and leading the workshops and hosting and attending parties with people I adore, and then feel equally great to proactively cut out a whole lot of other stuff that I don't like to do. It helps too that I can articulate this to people so they know why I don't want to fill in the blank.
That's right.
Did I mention that after living in New York City for 20 plus years, I now live on the side of a mountain? Literally, I live in the middle of nowhere on the side of a mountain. And regularly, I invite people to that mountain and we have a wonderful time. Mm-hmm. And I also head into the city for work and teaching and podcasting and occasional social stuff. And I consciously remind myself to meaningfully connect with people daily, because I know that's important for my well-being and for my brain health too. And I feel like I'm getting away with something by living on the side of the mountain in peace and quiet with my beautiful husband and my two stupid dogs. I absolutely love it. It feels correct, and I don't beat myself up anymore for living in alignment with my nervous system. Did you happen to listen to the episode of the podcast, Christine, where Lin-Manuel Miranda blew our minds by telling us he characterizes himself as an introvert?
That was crazy.
We are not alone, Christine. And it doesn't have to mean a glass ceiling on our professional success. It's just another piece of understanding and accepting ourselves. I hope this makes sense to you. Mwah. Susan. And that is my spark.
I love it. What a great spark.
Thank you to Susan Cain for your life's work. Thank you to Christine Cornish Smith for your email.
For asking the question, because I think a lot of people carry that guilt and concern around, like, can I do this work? Can I be in this business and be true to my natural state of introversion?
Yeah.
You can.
That's what I got for you, Cams.
Wow.
How Suze,
that was good.
Oh, thank you.
Good,
Cams,
good.
Likewise. Listen, that's it. We hope this put another bunch of sparks in your file. If there is a spark you'd like us to explore, or if you've taken a spark and fanned it into a creative flame and you'd like to share that, email us at thesparkfile@gmail.com or submit it through our website, thesparkfile.com.
We'll even take
com.
Oh,
how dare you?
Shit. Sorry. We'll even take your feedback, but you know the price of admission. First, you got to share a creative risk that you have taken recently.
Oh, shit.
Shit.
And be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Podcasts. Oh, no, it's
those
spreading.
Two.
Subscribe, rate, 5-star review it. If you like this podcast, share it with people you love. If you didn't like it, why are you still listening to this all the way to the end? You did like it.
You did like it. If something that's totally Sesame Street thing, like, don't, what isn't there that
the monster at the end of the book?
Yes, the monster at the end of the book.
I love that.
If something tickles your fancy and gets your creative juices flowing, please know that we are writing you a forever permission slip to make that thing that's been knocking at your door. It is your turn to take a spark and fan it into a flame.
Speaking of Sesame Street, you got to Ernie and Bert it. You got to airbrush t-shirt it. You got to do research like Susan Cain and full on introvert it. Yes! You got to take it
and make it.
Bye.
Yes. Bye.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my spark file. Could be something that I wanna make or how I wanna be. I pump it in my spark file. I jump into my spark file. Let's open up the spark file.